Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Dr. David Menashri makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He was here about a decade ago, where he also spoke on the issue of Iran. Dr. Menashri has written widely on the topic, and his most recent book is Iran, Anatomy of a Revolution. Our speaker is professor in the Department of Middle Eastern and African History at Tel Aviv University. He's currently a visiting professor at Monash University, and his trip to Australia has been sponsored by the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council, so thanks to them. And our speaker's going to talk for us on the topic tonight around what's happening. Dr. Menashri, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Anne and Jörg Andersen, and it's a pleasure to be here again in your wonderful city. And that great institute, I kept being informed about the activities and the range of activities, and it's really fascinating what they've been done over the ages. No, just I'm warming up my voice. So the Islamic Revolution has marked its 31st anniversary not long ago. And I think this has been done in light of what happened a year earlier in these elections to the presidency, in a degree of soul-searching process, with I think the main question being asked then and during the presidential election, what did we gain from this revolution? Did our expectation of our parents from 1979 have in any way materialized? Is our life today better than it used to be 31 years ago? And I think for many people in Iran, when they ask this question, the answer is not really. Well, the answer should be divided. New governments, new revolutionary movements, when they take over, they usually have two main aims in mind. First, when you take over, your main political instinct is to remain in power. And this was the aim of the Islamic Revolution. 31 years later, they have been fairly successful. 31 years after, the same revolutionary system is in place. Although there have been some changes and some movements within the ruling establishment between different factions of the revolutionary movement, but altogether the Islamic regime continues, and as far as we know, up to now, and I don't know what will happen tomorrow, the institutions of this revolution are generally, I can say, very firm and powerful. But revolutions don't come to our world simply to replace one government with another. The second aim of any revolutionary movement, or any new government, is to prove that their philosophy, their doctrine, their policy contains the cure to the problems of modern society. That the slogan, "Islam is the solution," in fact contains the cure to the problems of Iranian society. If this is the aim of the revolution, I think that the Islamic revolution cannot claim much success in its first 31 years in power. The Iranian people have been struggling more than any other nation in the Middle East over the last 120, 130 years to achieve two main aims. Broadly, I can define them as welfare and liberty, bread and freedom. A And I think they have not yet reached to this goal. The Islamic revolution in Iran, and here is question that we have to ask ourselves, what was the aim of this revolution? To be able to understand what is the situation today and how much there is satisfaction or dissatisfaction. The question is, why did the people of Iran in the first place go to revolution in 1979? I lived in Iran at that time doing research in Tehran. And I don't think that the main reason that people went to the streets identified with Ayatollah Khomeini and overthrown the Shah was merely to replace the Shah's government with Islamic regime or establish Islamic Republic in Iran. The main reason that people went to the streets was that life was miserable in Iran and they were looking for a way to elevate the situation of state and people. Khomeini provided the hope that he will bring them to better life. And I think this is important to understand, because when you speak about Islamic revolution, it is important that we understand that what we mean by Islamic revolution. Islam is a philosophy that covers all spheres of life. When people in Islam speak about Islam is the solution, what they have in mind is a whole set of values that it was a social revolution, economic revolution, political revolution, cultural revolution, anti-imperialist revolution. You can call all in Islam Islamic. Unlike Christianity, that there are separations between religion and state, religion and science, religion, so many other things. In Islam, like in Judaism, they are all concerned or related to religion. In the Middle East, our political structure is based on Islamic or religious values. Our social structure, economic policy, even what we feed, what we eat, is being influenced by our beliefs. So it was an Islamic revolution in the Islamic or Middle Eastern meaning of the word religion. But it was much wider than people in the West would call religion. Therefore, if this is correct, the final stabilization of the regime does not have to do with the degree of return to Islam, but rather with the degree that the problems facing the Iranian people would be removed by this regime. And related to this is the question of the philosophy of this revolution. And again, we call it Islamic revolution. Everything today has to do with Islamic revolution, Islamic fundamentalism, Islamic radicalism, Islamic terrorism. Everything is Islamic. What is Islamic in it? And to what degree it is Islamic? And this goes back to the question, is there one understanding of Islam? Well, no. Judaism, Christianity, Islam, they are all huge oceans of knowledge. And over ages, there have been different interpretations of what is the meaning of this religion. Religion is one, but our understanding and our take from it vary from generation to generation, from place to place. We do not practice Judaism today as Judaism used to be 3,000 years ago. Christianity is not exactly what it used to be 2,000 years ago. And why should we believe that Islam is exactly what it used to be in the 7th century when the Prophet Muhammad brought it to us? What I'm trying to say is that the Islamic revolution was one interpretation of Islamic philosophy. It happened to be the most radical interpretation. That what happened at Ayatollah Khomeini and his movement brought them from opposition to the center, from the margins to the center, and from opposition to power. And since then they have been ruling in Iran and influencing other movements all over the Middle East, mainly Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad. But the point is that even in Iran, when Khomeini came back victorious from exile in 79, none of the grand Ayatollahs supported the philosophy of Ayatollah Khomeini. The most learned Ayatollah in Iran, even according to the followers of Ayatollah Khomeini, Ayatollah Shariat Madari, was forced under house arrest until he passed away 7 years later. one of the most leading Ayatollahs in Iran, the man that Khomeini picked up to be his successor, and then he was removed from grace when he started criticizing the regime, was under house arrest until he passed away 8 months ago. The most leading Ayatollah in Iraq, a Shiite Ayatollah, of course, Sistani, who was of Iranian origin, does not agree with Ayatollah Khamenei or with Ayatollah Khomeini. So what we have to understand that we would speak about Islam or radical Islam or even Iranian type of Shiite Islam, there is more than one interpretation. And to make it better understood, maybe I should quote a leading Iranian intellectual who supported Khomeini, who was with him, who was responsible for the cultural revolution in Iran in the early days of the revolution. And a few years ago, he said the following sentence: there is no one interpretation of Islam. There is no one interpretation that is better than the other. And there is no final interpretation of Islam. And in a very courageous way, he said, and there can be no official interpretation of Islam. Namely, even the officials of the Islamic Republic cannot come and say that they know what is the meaning of Islam more than others. There is a degree of pluralism and different attitudes and different interpretations in Islam, in Shiite Islam. And what we see in Iran is that a very radical interpretation has been intercepted or taken by the ruling elite and brought to power. There are different ways to understand Islam. There are different ways to understand Shiite Islam. And there are many other clerics who think differently about the way that religion should be interpreted in our days. Certainly there are many intellectuals in universities and authors of very important books who think differently. And the third issue is that to what degree the policy of this regime is in line with the philosophy of the Islamic Islamic Revolution at the time that they came to power in 79. And here there is no surprise. Like any other revolution in history, there is a huge gap between what governments say in opposition and what they do when they are in power. And I'm not referring to your government. That in opposition, there is no tax on promises. They tell you, they propose to you the ideal situation that they want to bring you to. What's the problem? When they come to power, they are confronted with the realities of life, which sometimes, or more often than not, does not convince them, promote them, to change their ideology for the sake of pragmatic consideration of their regime or their state. And that's exactly what happened in Iran over the last 31 years. Almost on each and every case that there was a clash between ideology and interest, interest won over ideology. To a degree that Ayatollah Khomeini, the founding father of the revolution, comes up with a fatwa, religious decree, that states, I think it's very important and courageous, the fatwa, in which he says that for the sake of the good of people, for the sake of maslaha, whoever knows Arabic or Persian here, the good of the people, the interest of the people, it's legitimate for Islamic regime to destroy a mosque and suspend the five basic principles of Islam. There is nothing more than that that an Ayatollah can say in favor of pragmatism. We don't have much time, but I beg you to trust me. If there is any questions later on, I will answer. There was not even a single issue, maybe one or two exceptions, that they preferred to continue with their ideology when they were faced with high price that they have to pay for it. How much to pay, what it will be the rate of change, which is legitimate. On this, there are differences between different schools, groups within the country. And Iran is not black and white. I think sometimes the media in the West is doing misjustice to the Iranians, portraying them in one color or the other. There are different colors to this wonderful society. There is a group of reformists, pragmatic, moderates, you call them whatever you want. There is civil society in Iran that I don't think many countries in the Middle East have anything that comes close to what the Iranians have. Student organization, women organization are the most active in the Middle East. Cinema industry in Iran is the best in the Muslim world. Newspapers published in Iran are wonderful to read until they are being shut down by the authorities. Books published in Iran are fascinating to read, and I wish more of them would have been translated into Hebrew. Because we also have some problems with religion and state in our country. So we have, you know, I'll give you a title, name of title of a book published in Tehran by, again, all of them revolutionaries, all of them students of Khomeini, following Khomeini's line. Akbar Ganji, who wrote a book by the title A Fascist Interpretation of Islam, claiming that Islamic regime is fascist. Well, of course he went to jail. You can't publish such a book in Iran not to go to jail. But I think that the book was published in Tehran and sold in so many editions, speaks for itself. Hojatul Islam, Mohsen Kadivar, all of them now are out of the country, out of jail and out of the country. This is the routine. You support the revolution, you start criticizing, you go to jail, then you go out. And mostly go to the country of the great Saturn, the United States. And Akbar Ganji was one of the students who occupied the American embassy in Tehran in 79. And they started as revolutionary. It happened to all of us. Now, when we are young, we are different. It's revolutions like people, they mature. And that's what the point that I'm trying to take, and I come to the political conclusions of it soon. So, Mohsen Kadivar wrote a big article. The title is fascinating. I don't know how many of you speak Persian and Arabic here, but it says, I translate this, the basic problem of Iran is the rule of the clergy. If the rule of Velayat al-Faqih, the supreme religious authority. Well, of course, he also went to jail. So, I was speaking like that some time ago in Israel, a few years ago, and so one of our officials told me, you speak about degree of openness in Iran, but 100 liberal newspapers were shut down in 5 years. How you reconcile for this? And I say, you know, the very fact that there have been 100 liberal newspapers to shut them down is also important. And I think this is the half full of the glass. And I'll come to it. That's important, that's nice. I think that a country that has students, as the Iranians have, 60% of the students in Iran are female. 60 years ago, there was not a single woman in Iranian university. So there are positive elements and developments within civil society. Now, speaking about with an Iranian friend about this dichotomy between suppression and free expression, and he told me, you know, they tell you there is no freedom of expression in Iran. That's not true. We have freedom of expression. The problem is we don't have freedom after expression. So it is, I think, this for me explains the situation in Iran. That's a cat and mouse, but the main problem is those wonderful people that we are speaking about. I mean, much of my time to say that there are wonderful things happening in Iran. They don't have any share in deciding the policy of Iran. For 8 years, they had a reformist president in Iran, Khatami. What did he do? What policy changed? They didn't allow him, because in Iran the president is not the head of the state. And there are powers above him. For 8 years, reformists were in power, in presidency, in government, in parliament. Nothing really happened. And then, soon enough, after they spoke too much, they were removed. And today, while we have 8 years, the most reformist, pragmatic President Khatami, we have the most radical of all radicals in Iran, Ahmadinejad. And Ahmadinejad is the only president in Iran who became more radical in office than he was out of office. And I think it's also, based on what I said, it speaks for himself. Here we have something with a person that is dogmatic, and it's on all issues very, very radical. What is the power of this more, the other group, the radicals, extremists, fundamentalists? You can name them whatever you want. But of course, there are more than two factions in Iran, but I said, broadly speaking, these are the two. Within the more conservative, there are also differences of opinion. But again, Ahmadinejad is on the right scale or extreme scale of the political map. And these radicals, they have three major elements of power. First, they present themselves as the spokesperson in the name of Islam. They wake up in the morning and then tell people what is real Islam and what is should their policy be and what should their behavior be based on what they think this is the real interpretation of Islam. Basically, the spokesperson of God on earth. Now, if you have the power to be representative of Almighty on earth, it's powerful. Just in case this is not enough, and it should be enough, but if it's not enough, they have the revolutionary guards and their military power. So if you speak in name of God, in name of Islam, and you have the revolutionary guards on your other side, you are pretty safe. So there is not much that you need more than that. Well, there is one other thing, which is the determination to use your power to control the country and suppress your opponents. And they have plenty of it. And they are determined, and they say it explicitly, not to let their opponents to do to them what they did to the Shah 31 years ago. They surely have learned the lesson of the Islamic Revolution of 79. Ayatollah, Grand Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi, the mentor of Ahmadinejad, said the following sentence in a Friday sermon when the military was suppressing the students. He said, "Whoever thinks that Islam is the religion of mercy does not understand the meaning of Islam. Islam," said Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi, "dictates to us to take a sharp sword and cut the heads and tongues of people who act or speak against us." I don't think there is much that I have to add to the liberty they have taken upon themselves to interpret Islam and impose their will on the people. A year ago, something interesting happened with the elections to the presidency in Iran in June 2009. I don't want to repeat the story. You have all seen in the screens the courageous young people going to the streets asking, "Where is my vote?" and being brutally suppressed. Now, is it over? A year later, I doubt. On the surface, they have been suppressed. Under the surface, the fire of rebellion still rages. And this is so because the degree of dissatisfaction, disillusionment is so high that people once again will raise their voice when it's more appropriate opportunity. The result of this movement was the suppression of the young people. But in what price? The Islamic regime lost its legitimacy in the eyes of many of its own young people. A regime that was based on morals, on ideology, on philosophy of Islam, is based more and more on the power of the revolutionary guards. Ayatollah Khamenei downgraded his position himself from supreme leader to a small political factor or actor on this political scene, identifying with one faction against the other, unlike the policy of Ayatollah Khomeini that was much more smart and much more charismatic. And he never identified with one group against the other. He was always above. Ayatollah Khamenei became a political actor rather than supreme leader. He never had the religious authority to be supreme leader, and he's being less recognized as such in the eyes of the people of Iran. And let me ask you, when the people of Iran go and shout in the streets, "Death to dictator, death to dictator," whom do they have in mind? Only Ahmadinejad? I doubt it. when at the end of the Shah's rule, he wanted to appease the opposition, he removed the prime minister and appointed one of the opposition to the prime minister, Shahpur Bakhtiar. You know what the people said in the streets? We asked to change the horse, he changed the saddle. The issue is not the saddle, the issue is much more than this. Of course, this movement had its own shortcomings. They don't have cohesive alternative ideology, no charismatic leadership, no structure and organization. And I think also it's very difficult to come and change to a degree from within, as the Green Movement wanted to do. Now, Khomeini wanted to change everything. His slogan was, "The Shah must go." You know where you stand. Islam is the solution. Well, you think you know what it means. What did Mousavi say? I want to change 30% of the political structure, 40% of the economic system, 50% of the political system. I've never conducted revolution in my life, but I don't think that's the way you can go to revolution. You have to be absolute. Like Khomeini, the Shah must go. The other point, I think this is the most important weakness of this movement. Revolutions in history, no matter if they come from Europe or America or China or Iran, they are always based on two principles, on two main themes: social justice and political justice, equality and liberty. French Revolution, American Revolution, taxation and representation went hand in hand, like equality and liberties go hand in hand. This movement was almost exclusively based on democracy, on liberties. And you know what? In the Middle East still, regardless of how democracy is important, you cannot enlist the millions of people under the flag of fight for democracy. You need also, alongside this slogan, "Where is my vote?" I coined for them another slogan that offered the free of charge, no royalties asked, "Where is my oil money?" And I think that would supplement the dissatisfaction or the dissatisfaction of the people. Now, what is the concern with Iran? And why I am concerned, I think the world is concerned, or the world should be more concerned. I think that the main problem is, it's not the nature of the regime in Iran. They can have whatever regime they want. That's not my concern, that shouldn't be your concern, I think. The problem is the policy of this regime, not the nature of this regime. They want to have Islamic Republic, be my guest, have an Islamic Republic. You want monarchy, have a monarchy, whatever you want. The concern is what the policy, and the policy of this regime, and the ideology of this regime, is very harmful to its neighborhood, not only to its people. Because of this combination between radical ideology and the possibility of having, on the other hand, nuclear capabilities. I think the world can live with Iran going nuclear, and there is maybe legitimate need for Iran to have nuclear energy for peaceful purposes. But that's the problem. It's the combination of the two that is problematic. Now, many people think that it's the problem of Israel. I don't know if it's good or bad news for you. Iran is not only, not exclusively, the problem of Israel. You should understand, Israel is such a small, tiny country. For an Islamic revolution that wants to change the pillars of humanity, you think the only thing is Israel? They view themselves as an alternative to the failing world ideologies. There was communist Soviet Union, capitalist America, one of them collapsed, the turn of the other is sure to come, and Islam is the solution. Islam is the ideology for mankind. Islam is the alternative for these failed ideologies. If you have this kind of philosophy, Israel is peanuts. You know, to be honest with you, I don't know sometimes if they hate Israel because of the United States or they hate the United States because of Israel. Probably both of them. But look at this, what their own vocabulary. They call America the great Satan. Israel thinks God is the lesser Satan. So even in their own vocabulary, Israel is not the main issue. Iranian access to nuclear power would change the geostrategic map of the Middle East for the neighborhood and for Europe and beyond. Now, in the last few minutes that I have, what can be done? My basic conclusion, having studied Iran something like 40 years and followed the Iranian revolution since its first day in power, I strongly believe that Iran is not immune from pressure. It's not such a great and powerful country like they think they are. One can pressure Iran, and Iran can be pressured. Its history shows, and I started, that wherever there was a clash between ideology and interest, interest won. You have just to make them choose between their interest and their ideology. And I think what they will have to pay high price for pursuing a certain policy, they would retreat. No one asked them not to have nuclear program. But it should be transparent with the world watching what's going on, and then they should tell the truth to the IAEA. But then I think that in these delicate times, and given the attitudes towards Iran in its neighborhood, in the Muslim world and beyond the Muslim world, they should delay their nuclear program for 2, 3, 4, 5 years. It's not such a big issue. And settle this issue peacefully. Now, what can be done? I touch upon three levels of solution. One is what I usually call American-led solution or Western world-led solution that can be divided to two parts, dialogue and pressure. I think dialogue is important. I supported dialogue with Iran from its first day, even before Obama was candidate to presidency. And I can tell you, honestly, I don't believe that dialogue would solve the problem. The problem with the Iranians, they are very shrewd and sophisticated. They are good diplomats. And after a year of dialogue, they will come and tell you, I know the answer. It may range between no, however, to yes, but. As good diplomats, they will start with yes. And then you go back to the first stage. So why dialogue is open is important? Dialogue is important to convince two peoples of the good intentions of the world. The world should show its good intention. And you show it with dialogue. And that dialogue speaks to the Iranian people, and dialogue speaks also to the American people, that you tried everything before you move to more severe steps. The only country that is fearful of dialogue is the Islamic Republic of Iran. And they say, I think rightly, that this is not a carrot and stick policy. The carrot is poisoned. They understood that entering dialogue with the world would present America as a nice country that is willing to speak with you. The last thing that they want is to sit with America and speak. Then there is pressure. And I think the main motive of my talk is that you can pressure Iran, but let me give you a few examples. I hope the world will not go to war with Iran. I hope very much that this will not end with any military confrontation. Not with Israel, not with the Muslim Arab world, and not with the United States of the West. It's not going to serve the interests of anybody. But you can pressure Iran in different ways. Like, what about moral pressure? What's going on in the jails in Iran? What's going on to civil society in Iran? What's going on to women in Iran? Unveiled. What about freedoms? What will happen to the students, the young people who demonstrated a year ago? How long they have going to pay the price? For in what form? For what? For struggling unarmed for democracy in that country? To achieve the goal of generations of Iranians? Iran is the only country in the Middle East which had a constitutional revolution. Iranians have gone again to revolution in 79. You have a country, how many countries you have in the world that had two big mass movements, revolutions in one century? You can't silence them. But I think that you have to help the green movement in Iran and the young people of Iran by showing this, putting a mirror in face of this government. Political pressure. Shirin Ebadi, and I don't speak about for myself, Shirin Ebadi won the Nobel Prize for Peace in Iran. She suggested a year ago for the Western world to downgrade the representation in Iran from ambassadorship to Chargé d'affaires. If some few countries will do it, it will be a huge pressure on the Iranian government. Then you have economic sanctions and different others. And I think that I must admit, in the last few months, some positive steps have started. And Australia has been part of it, followed by other countries. But this should be going on. The second level of solution is to try and solve the problems in the Middle East. Now today, fortunately for me as an Israeli, the Middle East is not that much Arab-Israeli conflict. You can end a day of discussion with officials of a foreign country, including in your country, speaking about Iran, and the name of the Palestinians will not come up. It doesn't mean that there is no such problem, but it means that it's not today in the main focus rather of the world. But today we are living in new realities in the Middle East in which the Arab world is being weakened, Shiite Islam is being strengthened. The geostrategic map in this sense, the power centers of the Middle East have shifted. What we used to call Arab nationalism and Arab world has withdrawn and became much weaker than they used to be. The Arab nationalism of President Nasser in Egypt, or Arab socialism of the Baas of Syria, of the Baas of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, Hafez al-Assad, even Numeiri, Gaddafi, where are all these Arab states? No, an interesting episode is that I had a meeting with an Arab friend for dinner some time ago during the time of the flotilla. And he told me, see what's going on, because both Turkey and Iran were competing who is more pious than the Pope, who is more Palestinian than the Palestinians. And he told me, see what a strange world. We the Arabs are quiet and silent. In fact, Egypt is in line with Israel. And the Ottoman Empire, he says, not Turkey, Ottoman Empire and the Persian Empires, and they became the representative of the Arab world, or representing the Arab world to save the Palestinians. Then you see what's going on in the Middle East today. If you want to name the main powers in the Middle East, you have Turkey, Iran, Israel. None of them is Arab. And you look at the change in Shiite Sunni world. No, I don't think that Iran is Shiite, Shiism is going to take over the Middle East. But when I sometimes read Arab newspapers, I came to the conclusion that Shiism is the majority now. When you have President Mubarak asking to whom the Shiites in the Gulf are faithful, to their own countries or to Iran, it shows the fear. When King Abdullah of Jordan speaks about the Shiite crescent, it reflects the fear of the Arab world from the Sunni world. And there I think, therefore, it is important to try and solve the other problems in the Middle East, which is good in itself for Arabs and Israelis, but it also will help to weaken Iran. And finally, the main change, I believe, can come and would come only from the people of Iran. They brought this regime to power, and they are the people who have the right and the power to change the policy of this regime or change the regime, whatever they want. The problem is that we don't have much time. There are two trains which have already left the terminal in Tehran. One train is carrying the nuclear message, and the other train is carrying the message of political change in Iran. I think the West can be very influential in the interplay between the two trains and make sure that the train with Iranian nuclear power will not get to its final destination before there is significant political change or policy change in Iran. I am confident that this will come. Having studied Iranian history and seen the Iranian people courageous and fighting for their to define the policy of their country, the problem is that popular movements in history are usually unexpected. And you can never tell when a mass movement one day will start sweeping. It can be tomorrow, 2 years from now, 20 from now, years from now, I don't know when. In the meantime, the nuclear scientists in Iran go to their work every day, and the nuclear clock continues to tick. Thank you.
Many thanks, Dr. Banashri. Once again, thanks to Lauren Jones and Colin Robinson of the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council who made this possible today. So we come to questions and discussions. There are a lot of people here, so we can have brief questions or points and brief responses. So can I just start off? The news, I guess, out of the region this week is probably the decision, the report of the decision of the United States government to provide a lot of new military, advanced military equipment to Saudi Arabia. Tonight you spoke about Egypt's concern about Iran, you spoke about Jordan's concern. Saudi Arabia is not arming against Israel, it must be arming presumably against Iran. What's the relationship between the Saudis and the Iran government? We just talk to the end of the room now.
Yeah, okay. That's it's a good question, and you asked to be brief, so what can I do? You go to history, relations between Iranians and Arabs are not usually very good. If you want to offend Iranian, tell him you are Arab. In more recent history, the hostility between Iran and the Arab countries was huge, including a war between Iraq and Iran that more people were killed than in all the Jews and Arabs killed in 100 years of conflict between Zionist movement and the Arab countries. With Arab Saudi Arabia, because Iran is a religious Islamic revolution, and Saudi Arabia is also a religious country that views itself as the leading force in the Muslim world, the protector of the Haramain or Sharifain, the two main shrines, it brings them to conflict. Iran thought that the revolution should be exported, and during the 80s you could see the infightings between between Iranian pilgrims and Saudi's authorities during the Hajj. Every year after year, so many people were killed. Because Saudi Arabia didn't think that the Hajj is a political event that you can speak against the United States, and Iran thought that exactly this is the meaning of Hajj. Now about this arms deal, I know that the Iranians are concerned. You are right. The main reason for selling arms, I would say, to Saudi Arabia, they pay for it. It's not any gift that they are receiving. Is there a Saudi concern of the Iranian neighbor? Now, they should ask themselves why the Saudis are so eager to have more weapons. Partly because of the fear of the Islamic revolution in Iran. So I think that it is today Iran is the major power in the Persian Gulf, and because of its policy. And because of the tense relations, you know, I was told by an Iranian friend, you know, we have legitimate reasons to concern. We have 10 or 11 neighbors. We don't have good relations with any of them. He said, well, it's about time you ask yourself why you don't have good relations. It's just so the tension exists all over the Iranian borders. Today there is, maybe Turkey is coming to be more friendly. But if you ask me, even Turkey, I don't think that at the end of the day there is more competition than cooperation between these two countries. If they both compete to be the leading force in the Muslim world, this will bring them to some kind of conflict.
There's a question here. Yeah.
Yeah, you talk about accountability of the nuclear industry in Iran, and couldn't agree more, but how accountable is Israel about such a matter?
The question is about the accountability of Israel on its nuclear capacity.
Do you think I didn't understand him?
No, I'm telling
you. Oh, no. Okay, to them, to them.
No, I'm talking for our podcast. Our podcast and the people down the back.
I wish I would understand this question, but it is a good question. Israel is not a member of the NPT. And I tell you, I understand this is a serious question, important question. The problem that I have, or the reason that I think that Israel should still stick to its nuclear policy, is that as long as we have neighbors who want to destruct the state of Israel, I, as an Israeli, would support that Israel will have all the arms to protect itself. And I can give you one more point. I remember the days of the 1973 wars in Israel. When the defense minister of Israel spoke about the end of the Third Temple, basically the destruction of the Jewish state of Israel, Israel did not use it. Israel did not threaten to use nuclear weapon, which the world believes Israel has. So when you speak about a democratic country, an accountable country...
How accountable?
Hang on.
Listen, I don't know. So far, it has been accountable. What do you want more than that Israel is going to be destroyed and it doesn't use the arm that you think is there for this use? I think Israel will never use nuclear weapon. And I believe also that other countries, and I get more than that. I don't think that if Iran will have nuclear weapon, it's going to throw it on Tel Aviv or in any other country. My problem is that it will change the balance of power, the strategic map of the Middle East, and it's true that other countries have. The fact that India has, Pakistan has, Israel, you say, has, other have, it doesn't mean that I should tolerate all more and more countries of this in the region to have nuclear weapon. Now, Iran will not be the last.
Okay.
Yes, so if Iran will have, Egypt will have, Saudi Arabia will have, this will... But I'm sure that I cannot convince you fully that Israel deserves something that it asked to be deprived from other countries.
No, we're not having a dialogue here. We're having a question and discussion period, and there are a lot of people here, you may have noticed. Okay, so I'll call down there, then I'll come over here. And we just have one comment and a response. Okay.
Briefly, has the guards got an organisation like the Stasi, and as thorough as the Stasi, to support them against the students and others who are democratic or, you know, progressive?
I'll be brief but wider. I think that this is an important question. Who rules Iran today? But we can speak about Khamenei, supreme leader, Ahmadinejad, or Revolutionary Guards. I think that it's not Ahmadinejad. I think to a large degree today it's the Revolutionary Guards. The machinery that they have is, I don't want to compare it with any other organization, has been proven useful in suppressing their own people so far.
There's a question down there. Yeah. Yes, there. Yeah. Go ahead.
You used the metaphor of the green in the train and also of the atomic energy train as though they were conflicting. But to what extent are they conflicting? If there was a green movement which created a more democratic or less radical Islam, would it still be anti-nuclear, or would it be quite a nuclear weapons anyway?
That's I need your help.
You think I speak English? I didn't quite get that one. It was
Can you repeat it?
The question was:
Is there any guarantee that if there was a was a green movement, they actually would have.
They would take a different policy. No, I think that there is a consensus among Iranians that they deserve to have nuclear capabilities. Certainly, they speak about peaceful purposes. But I think within the reform movement, there are sufficient leaders who, although recognize the right of Iran to have nuclear capabilities, may be willing to postpone it for a certain period of time. And that's, I think, the issue. The nuclear program in Iran started under the Shah with the blessing of the West. And there is no reason to think that Iran is the only country who should not have nuclear energy. The combination between the nuclear capabilities and this radical ideology, that's the concern.
There's a question around the corner there. Yeah. You've got to be quick. Yep.
Yeah. Thank you very much. This was really fascinating talk. And as a person, I was impressed by the level of the accurate information and the deep analysis that you had from the domestic policy. But I have a concern regarding your point about the nuclear power or nuclear program in Iran. Please, you took the talk to the nuclear power. You quoted from the Miswabi as the Ahmadinejad, saying that think of this guy who discovered having the nuclear power and how dangerous that can be to the world. But that's not the point. I mean, Miswayat and Ahmed, as you well know, doesn't represent the Iran. Even if they don't represent the government. The government or the Islamic State, one certain element about the Islamic State during this 31 years has been that it has been a realistic and pro-Muslim government. I mean, let's just say.
Okay, we've got to be quick. Your suggestion is that the government be realistic.
Yeah,
okay.
All I'm saying is that Kundari, if you believe that the civil society and the Iranian people are the main source of the changes in Iran, we should encourage the investment of the people, not the nuclear issues.
Well, I think that you are right. The Iranian government should invest more on their own people, feeding the people rather than nuclear energy.
Okay. We can't have a dialogue because we've got a lot of people in this question here. Yeah.
I just want to say you talked about dialogue. Didn't Obama try the dialogue and it wasn't too successful?
Well, I think that Obama tried dialogue. He went, you know, Iranians always claim that they are not being respected. I think Obama gave them respect. He went to Sharm el-Sheikh and speak with the Muslim world. He before that gave a New Year message to the Iranian people, mentioning explicitly the Islamic Republic of Iran, its first president in America who has done so. That was interpreted as recognizing the legitimacy of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He did not insist or could not achieve face-to-face dialogue with the Iranians. And it is philosophy of dialogue turned to be the 5+1. The 5+1 started under President Bush. So I think that it not achieved its goal. But if you look at the Green Movement in Iran, it will be very difficult to convince me the eruption of this movement in June 2009 is not related to the coming to the White House of President Obama in January the same year. The reason is not that Obama wished to accelerate his political change in Iran. On the contrary, when they went to the streets, and this is the claim of the Green Movement, he did not speak for 10 days to endorse or say a word about civil rights. But he gave hope that yes, we can. And he gave the hope that the people, when they go to the street, a president who put civil rights so high on his agenda would support them. This did not materialize.
So, we're going to be the second last question here. Yeah. Be quick.
This is actually a request for Gerard to invite you back. Under the Shah, supported by the West, the situation was extreme. Then we had the Khomeini revolution and the pendulum swung exactly the opposite way. And it seems to me, is there any hope that Iran can have a middle path between these two real extremes?
Can we have the last question before last? I want to answer this question, but after, because it's good to conclude this.
I'll ask the second last question. just very briefly, because we've only got about 5 minutes total, you haven't said much about the relation between Iran and Iraq, which is now presumably a Shiite government in Iraq. I mean, what's the relationship there? Just a very brief response, then we'll take this final question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if I would go and count what I didn't speak about today, it would be, I hardly mentioned Russia, I didn't mention China, and you are right. Iraq, but Iraq in is closer at home, it's important. Iran and Iraq have a long history of hostility. For the first time, there is an Arab country with Shiite majority. There may be another one in Lebanon in years to come, but right now there is one. The question is, what moves or what influence the policy of the Iraqi government? We know what the Iranians want. They want influence, but the Iranians, you know, they are not such big heroes and they go and change the world. Their policy is to wait and see there is the political structure falls one place and they penetrate to take that achievement. For example, Hezbollah was not created by Iran. But Iran took advantage of the collapse of the Lebanese state to support the Hezbollah and make it what it is. The same thing with the Gaza Strip. Iran did not have good relations with Hamas in the early days of Hamas. In Iraq also, the Iranians did not create the new situation. It's the Americans created it, or others, with others. Iran wants influence in Iraq and around its border, which is legitimate, I would say, for any country that is surrounded by such countries. My belief is, and it's not more than belief, it's not knowledge, because we don't know about the future, that at the end of the day, the Shiite of Iraq in government will behave more like Iraqis than like Shiites. And they will take care of the national interests of Iraq and not this philosophical brotherhood with the Shiite world. And now this issue of extremes. And I think it's a good way to conclude in 2 minutes or so our discussion. You're right, Iran has gone through extremes more than any other country. From a philosophy of the Shah, the center was the monarchy, and I would say in general the legacy of Cyrus the Great, Iranian nationalism, pro-American, westernizing philosophy, to totally the other extreme of, I would say, the legacy of Imam Ali, of Islam, supranational philosophy, anti-Western, whatever this regime liked, it became hated by the other regime. But I think that history has shown that it's very difficult to eradicate long time influence over Iran. And people ask, is the West, can the West go back to Iran? I have good news for you. The West is in Iran. You see, the Iranian young people in the streets, they reflect the philosophy of the Western world. Khatami is part of his philosophy, also his cites Western philosophers. The Iranian history was based on the monarchy and religion and state. The Shah tried to upset this balance and eliminate religion from the public sphere. He did not succeed. The Islamic Revolution, on the other hand, went to the other extreme, trying to eliminate the Persian culture and national loyalty from the soul of the Iranian people. And this was another failure. Two statues remained in Iran after the revolution, both of them for the great author Ferdowsi, who wrote the Shahnameh, the Book of Kings. They celebrate the New Year, which belongs to the pre-Islamic history. And I can go on and on to show how they became faithful, basically, to the principles that were endorsed during the monarchy. Constitutionalism, it's a Western philosophy that brought by the West in the 19th century to Iran. When Khomeini came to power, he didn't say, I don't want constitution because we have Islam. He has the constitution. He changed the constitution but kept his principle of constitutionalism, which is the peak of Iranian success, if you ask the Iranian people in that modern history. Modern education that was so difficult for the religious clerics to accept. They teach English as foreign language in Iran. They go to the street and say, "Death to America, death to America." And then they go to school and study English. And it's so bizarre that every textbook in English explains why you need to study English. To learn the enemy, to fight the enemy, to learn technology, to find the enemy. But still, and so I spoke about the big principles, constitutionalism, education, nationalism, which is Western philosophy. In Islam, there is no nationalism. Nationalism is alien to the spirit of Islam. The divide between people is not nationality, but rather faith. And all of Iranian policy, and it started with this, is national interest and national. Will it be a way to go to the middle? I think that's a very good question. And there is no other way but finding the middle way between the two major ethos of Iranian history. Nationalism, Persian culture, and Islam, Shiite Islam. I hope this balance would be found in peaceful faith to allow the prosperity of the people of Iran. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I'll be very brief. Tonight's talk will be up on the Institute's podcast, and Channel 648 on Foxtel and Austar is here recording this. And in time, our speaker's paper will be published in the Sydney papers online. But for now, I'd like to say to Dr. Munashri, it's great to have you back at the Sydney Institute. I remember you well from 2000, and here in 2010, the facts have changed a bit. The topic is still very important. So I've certainly learnt a lot tonight about Iran and what's happening in your interpretation, and you're very... your very reasonable and moderate stance on the topic, and it was great to hear it, and I'm sure in a decade or sooner we'd love to have you back. So well done. Thank you. Thanks, folks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.